So I need to warn you that he's been conjuring again. But you know his magic, right? It's not so much sleight of hand as it is sleight of mind. Well, that's not to say he's sleight of mind, hardly. But maybe slightly out of mind, because it's always everything, all the time, all the way. So I get the call, and all he says is, "This is darkness." I said, "Okay, but I don't do darkness." Well, not in public anyways. And so I said, "Well, maybe perhaps I could interest you in something of a, let's just say, lighter variety." And it did get him thinking, lighter, lighter, lighter light, until he said, "No, this is darkness." I said, "But wait, so do you mean like a yin-yang darkness, like a rich dark swirl with a light chewy center?" And he said, no, not so much. Okay, so not so much? More, actually. Okay, so more dark? Yes, this is darkness. So, but wait, yes. Well, it'd be unnatural for me to be, you know, that dark. And he said, "Well, it may be unnatural for you, but it's nature's nature, and that is where this whole thing is headed." And you know, he's right. Darkness, it's inevitable. So I said, "Well, you know, okay, we're all headed into darkness, but you know, each and every one of us is going to face it in our own way." And, you know, on that we agreed. And finally he said, "Well, you feel better now?" And I said, "Well, no."
That was the voice of Russ Chapman, man of words, music, and we have to say, one hell of a beard. Now, if you're wondering by now just exactly what the heck he's talking about and where he's going with this whole darkness thing, well, don't worry, you're not alone. There was a full crowd of people just like you gathered at the Paradise Theater in Paonia over the weekend, gathered for The Dark Knight. No, not the Batman movie, the actual thing, the real deal, the winter solstice, the darkest night of the year. Or as author, traveler, and poet Craig Childs describes it, the time of year when the snakes of winter coil tightly around us. When all of us in the Northern Hemisphere, whether we're aware of it or not, start leaning away from the sun and leaning into the dark. As Childs tells it, it's also a time for stories. And that's why those folks just like you gathered in Paonia over the weekend to celebrate and welcome the dark with stories. It was the fifth year Childs has put on this spoken word and multimedia extravaganza. Honestly, I didn't know what to expect, something about poems and flashing lights. Cool, sounds fun, but as the night went along, I realized I was witnessing the demented and beautiful theatrical vision of, well, maybe a demented and beautiful mind. Scratch that, definitely a beautiful mind. Tonight on Local Motion, a trip back in time, just a few days ago, to the Dark Knight performance. From the first flurries of a subtle Native American flute, it was clear we were all in for some kind of 21st century vision quest. And the journey started with a tale of a group of immigrants, traveling through the depths of the earth to reach a new and hopefully promising land. First, a quick disclaimer, we have to say that some of what you'll hear on this program tonight involves some graphic imagery, things like blood and dead bodies. Sensitive listeners might want to tune out.
There were 13 coming across the border that night. The tunnel was dark and long. You couldn't see but for one flashlight. It was three people ahead of you, all shadows and shoulders, and only one way out. 13 stooped and marched ahead through the tunnel, underground, under streets, under stores. There was a child in arms, footsteps in gravel, the curve of concrete. It was not wide enough to stretch out your hands, not tall enough to stand. It was the last keyhole they had to pass through. They had money on their minds and watermelons to pick, jobs in houses, drugs to carry. They had mouths to feed. They came through the tunnel to get to the other side. The south side border was Agua Prieta, Mexican dump town, fences flagged with plastic bags. At the Hotel Yolanda, the coyote was a hired man. No one later would say who he was. They don't have names, just coyote. He chose among many, but picked only few, those he thought that might get through, who could climb the fence and dodge the spotlights, the dogs, the barbed wire, the ditches, and trash. Flash flood country at some times of the year, all with a kid in arms. And you're lucky just to get this far. In Agua Prieta, you get raped, you get beaten or killed. People come looking for you, petty criminals or drug thugs. You can pay for protection, but you only have enough to pay the coyote to get you across. Did the coyote know about the storm and how you die? Maybe. It's all money anyway. In Agua Prieta, for the promised land, you have to pay to get across. You came from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from jungles and green, from far, far away from any desert like this. You came from a land with fields upon fields and wars upon wars, and a storm was brewing up where you were going, and it dropped rain like a prophecy. What you couldn't see from the tunnel deep, from the crunch of gravel and the little sleep, from the weight in your arms, on your back, in your heart, the journey to get here almost tore you apart, and you hadn't yet reached the end. Up in those bare catclaw mountains above town, down came the water from crags and arroyos running thick and wild. Water picked up anything from bones to sticks to cans to cars, tumbling them toward Douglas, Arizona, toward streets and grates and manhole covers sealing their fates. But they didn't know this, not yet. The only thing they knew were their steps. The swing of the light, the child in arms, the small ones, the old ones, people moving ahead, jeans and button-down shirts, backpacks and bags with papers and clothes. And the coyote had left them. He had pointed to the hole across the fence at the edge of the ditch. He'd shown them a concrete mouth, wastewater conduit draining a desert town. He said, go in, walk 9 blocks north, count manhole covers over your head as you pass. You'd find a tool left there for you. Pop the cover and you'd be in Douglas, Arizona, on the other side of the line. Well, the flood hit them at block number 5. Driving water, roar of rain, pumped down the gutters through every drain, clogged in the streets and carried below, till it roared and crashed and the flashlight was gone. What could you do in all of this dark, in the arms and the legs and the running and the splashing and the galling roar, leaving everyone thrashing? It came too fast to turn around, to run or to crawl. This is why the coyotes don't go down in the hole. Quick, up a manhole. A woman goes for the rungs and loses her daughter. 2-year-old girl swept away by the water. Hands find her first. A man, a stranger, he holds her tight as she's thrown and he's thrown head over heels. He can't hold on and the girl slips away. 2 men behind him field the toddler. They pass and shove her small body back toward the ladder. Again she flies. The water has her. Someone grabs her wrist and flings her ahead. Men call to each other, hands reach to hands, shoulders to ceiling, to feet, to floor. Water surrounds the man who grabs him, grabs her, and he hands up the child. The mother takes her. With that last man is swept away. The sound of his struggles fade, and he is gone. Same for the rest of the men who helped the girl, their hand bones later found shattered from trying to escape. Those who live longer have crawled up the manholes, water lapping at their feet and rising. 2 women are up a ladder, water coming up. One holds the girl, the other pounds at the cover over her head, trying to loosen it. Water to their knees, water to their waists. In another manhole, 2 men have found the same. They push with their backs, but the car must be parked on top of the manhole cover. The iron cover is stuck. Water bucks to their shoulders, their chins, and to their lips as they breathe off the last skim of air. And there it stops and the water begins to recede. These two are left alive. For the women and the child, the cover finally budges. It pushes off like a coin and out they climb. The storm has passed and the town is quiet. The flood came fast and is gone just the same. Across the corner from the mortuary and the auto repair shop, they run across a wet and lamp-lit street with a girl in arms. These three are alive. The dead, they number 8. Maria, Socorro, Ramirez, Pedroza, Ruben, Javier, Ramirez, Jose, Eloy, Olmedo, Solis, Javier, Castillo, Del Carmen, Juan Manuel Ortiz Hernandez. 3 others were never claimed, papers never found, names never named, survivors deported and bodies transported. 2 last bodies cannot be found. Down in the muck, the rescuers toil. In the oil and ooze, the tons of mud left by the flood, the last 2 bodies do not show. Lawyers and phone calls, accusations, family members missing. These accusations fly across the border in 110 degree heat, and the coyotes keep working. Fences keep falling, and all night long the dogs bark. 12 days later, another flood comes. The desert cries a torrent. The tunnel lets go. Mud washes out, and the last 2 are finally free.
You're listening to Local Motion here on KVNF. We're taking a look back at this past weekend's Dark Night performance held in Paonia and put together by author and generally intrepid wanderer Craig Childs. Dark Night, the performance, the concept, the vibe, seems to adore the idea of the paranormal. After his reading of that story you just heard, Childs talked about a photographer friend of his that went with him down into the depths of a city sewer, similar to the ones he describes in the story. From here, the evening's performance shifted into strange, even startling territory.
She lifted her camera while I was looking the other way, and she took a picture, and the flash shot past me. And for that instant, I had my headlamp off, and for that instant, I could see my own shadow just burn down the corridor, and it just left a mark on my eyes. It left this image. It left something fading, vision, memory, ghost. Are there ghosts down there, down in the sewers underneath town where these stories have happened? Are there ghosts all around us? Are we walking through the land of the dead all the time? You know, I have a recording of a ghost, and it didn't come from down there in the tunnels. This is a different story. I have a recording of a ghost, and it's from when I was reporting on a ghost hunting crew in a theater, an empty theater in downtown Los Angeles, and I got it on tape. And it's just a strange sound, and you'll have to listen to it. I'm recording the ghost hunting crew. We're sitting on the stage of this 100-year-old theater. So Jordan, can you just run that tape?
Those emotions she'll feel, the illnesses. If there's a heart attack victim, she would even feel that. Many times we find that as she starts giving us that information, the entity steps in and tries to communicate even more so, trying to tell us what happened to them. In this case, because Dana could acknowledge that the woman died in bed and probably has no connection with the theater, she might want to relay more information to us. No, what do you feel? Things are falling on you? Like bugs to me? Mm-hmm. I do have a 9-degree temperature drop.
Okay, so it was that just that one sound right in the middle. And let me back up a few steps. You need to get a picture of this theater first of all. This is a theater that's right smack in downtown LA. It's called the Million Dollar Theater. And at one time it was the largest theater in the country. It's actually a significant landmark. It was in Blade Runner. It made this brief appearance in the movie. It's called the Million Dollar Theater. And you look at just looking at the front of this theater, it's got all these animal forms, skulls, and these human figures all across the top of it. These eyeless, strange figures. I remember when they rolled up the front of it to go in, and I'm just looking up, going, "Wow, that is creepy. This is perfect." And you know, this ghost hunting crew was a goofy bunch of people. I don't know what they were doing. The theater was having trouble keeping employees just to keep the play for upkeep because there were so many ghost things going on. So they brought in this ghost hunting crew. And it's just this beautiful space. And the fact that the head ghost hunter, he kept calling himself a scientist. And then he said, "Well, I was also a bodyguard for Hugh Hefner." And, you know, at that point, you're going, "All right, this is a bunch of nonsense, but I'll record this story." You know, and we didn't have the lights on. We were just going with flashlights through there, which, you know, I kept saying, "Shouldn't we be turning the lights on?" And they were going, "No, you got to use flashlights." I was like, "Right, it's creepier. Definitely creepier." And how they work is they have all this equipment measuring static electricity and temperature, and then they send psychics in. And the psychics say things like, they go, "Oh, there's somebody coming through the wall." And I'd be looking going, I don't see anybody. And everybody's running over and going, yep, we're picking up something here. And then they run someplace else and go, yep, there's something here. So apparently they're just ghosts all over the place. And as you're looking around the inside of the theater, you see it's whoever designed this was a spooky person. There are all these pentagrams and animal forms, and so what was going on there? This psychic was rolled up in a ball, just going, "The bugs, there are bugs all over me," and I'm sitting on the stage with a mini cassette player, just going, "Yeah." So the story of this ghost isn't actually from the theater; it's from when I was transcribing the tapes. After I do weeks of interviews on different stories, I'll go sit down somewhere and just open my computer, put on headphones, and type in the interviews. And this time I was doing it in the basement of the ASU library in the stacks on a Sunday night. So nobody's in there, and I'm in a cubicle with my back facing the stacks. And have you ever been in big university stacks when nobody's in there? You know, it's all a bunch of dusty books, you know, millions upon millions of books and aisles upon aisles and shadows upon shadows. But, you know, I'm fine. I'm just transcribing all this different stuff until I get to that sound. And I heard something and I went, "You know what? I just heard something on there that was not there in the theater. So let me rewind it and listen to it again."
Those emotions she'll feel, the illnesses. If there's a heart attack victim, she would even feel that.
So this is Hugh Hefner's bodyguard talking right now. He sounds good, doesn't he? He sounds like a scientist. And so I'm just sitting there typing, going, "Okay,
trying to
get all this down.
What happened to them?
Heart attack victim."
Because Dana could acknowledge.
Dana's over there.
The woman died in bed,
curled up in a ball, freaking out about bugs.
You might want to relay more information.
So, move the recorder over to Dana.
No, what do you feel? Things are falling on you? Like bugs to me?
Okay, there was definitely something there. Definitely some sound. Okay, so rewind it. Listen to it again. What was that?
Things are falling on you? Bugs, you mean?
Okay, so what is that? I'm playing it at different speeds, and I'm going, "Oh my, there is something there."
Like
Okay, so I don't know what this is recording of, but it... Okay, so at that point, I just threw my headphones off and just backed out of the cubicle into the stacks going, okay, what did I just hear? Because this might not be a recording that actually came from the theater. This might be something here in the stacks that's putting itself on my tape. And I, you know, it was just one of those moments that I'm looking around in the stacks and I'm backing away from my computer just going, ah, this is that moment in the movie where the journalist who's typing it in hears the ghost and backs up, and then some kind of gnarly claw just rakes through his chest, just rips out of the books around you, and blood is just spattered everywhere. What is this? I mean, maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's nothing at all. But it sounds like something. I took this recording to Jeff Reynolds, and we digitized it, and we moved through it to hear all different angles, and I remember Jeff just going, this is just creepy. And I said, this is not something that could be on the tape, and he said, no, this is not something that could be on the tape. This is something that you recorded. Personally, I think ghosts are everywhere, and I don't know what they are. Maybe they're echoes, maybe they're shadows, visions, memories. There's something else going on here. I mean, how much do our senses really take in from the actual world? We just see through this keyhole. We are not seeing the whole world around us. We are just seeing moments. They're underground. They move in the air around us. We're passing through them all the time. There is an invisible world. What are they? I don't know. Maybe we're not even asking the right questions.
Craig Childs, telling about one of what are surely his many and varied strange encounters with the paranormal, the unseen of this world, the things that reside in the dark. Tonight on Local Motion, we're taking just a peek into Child's performance of Dark Knight, held in Paonia this past weekend. While the evening was indeed filled with visions from the dark side of the world, there were also glimpses of the light, visions of purity, of grace.
Now is the time to know that all that you do is sacred. Now is the time to understand that all your ideas about right and wrong were just a child's training wheels to be laid aside when you finally live with veracity and love. My dear, please tell me, what is it in that sweet voice inside that incites you to fear? Now is the time for the world to know that every thought is sacred. This is the time for you to compute the impossibility that there is anything but grace. That was written by my dear friend and lover, Hafiz. And so now, the case for grace. Whenever I get into these debates with you-know-who, my adversary, I always feel a bit outclassed because, well, face it, he's a words guy. Am I right? And I am the stuff of divine love, beauty, truth, and compassion. He is trying to buy your soul. And I'm not in the business of anything like that at all. I use poems and music, sunsets, and the feel of a baby in your arms to bring you to your knees. Perhaps that's why my lovers and agents have always spoken in parables and prose. I am a spring. Come, drink my water. Oh, the wind, it is a song that harbors through the winter. Oh, the sail, it is a door that bids the song to enter. Drink. Drink. Drink in life's wonder, but do not gulp so thirstily as to not even taste what is offered up. Drink, but do not take it all. I am here to give you exactly what you need. My dears, you have much to learn. This reminds me of a story, a cautionary tale of sorts, about a spring and a pipeline. Once upon a time, as all good stories are wont to begin, there was a village suffering from drought. And the villagers searched far and wide for water and discovered, miraculously it seemed, a pure spring high in the hills and far away. And they were so happy. And even though it was a long, difficult journey, they would go to the spring often to drink pure water from the source. But soon they began to notice that it was quite a long trip, and it was hard to carry back all the water that they wanted. So they conceived of a pipeline, the greatest task that they could ever set for themselves. And with much effort, and after many false starts, they were able to build it. And it made them happy. For now they could enjoy the water from the spring right in their very own village. Now the villagers would be the first to admit that their pipeline was not perfect. Having to use the materials they had at hand, they had built it from a thin bamboo which impeded the flow, and they had used a tar for the joints that sometimes could make the water taste a little funny. But even though they enjoyed their pipeline, some of them would still make the long journey back to the hills to drink the pure water from the source. Time passed. And eventually, all of those who had discovered the spring and who had built the pipeline passed on. Their children had been told about the spring, and they believed in it, because after all, they had proof in the existence of the proof of the existence because the water flowed right into the village. But few of them had actually been to the spring. But they were satisfied, and they appreciated the funny tasting water and the pipeline, and they were content. More time passed, and soon the flow of water began to wane, and sometimes even stopped completely. The villagers assumed that the spring was dying away, but in reality, the pipeline was failing because it was old and because it was being neglected. The villagers began to grumble, and they began to doubt all that they had ever heard about the spring. Needing water, some of them moved to other villages. Those that remained tried to get by on the water that still flowed through the pipeline, though now it was scarce and tasted foul. A few, a very few, went searching and followed the old pipeline up until the hills, until they discovered the spring for themselves, as full and as fresh and as pure as it had ever been.
Thanks for joining us this evening on Locomotion as we've taken a look back at Dark Night, the spoken word and multimedia celebration of the winter solstice from Craig Childs. If you missed any of today's episode or you'd like to hear old episodes of Locomotion, you can find them online at kvnf.org.